Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series, our final podcast for 2014. Today's session is entitled Understanding Transverse Myelitis, TM 101. My name is Roberta Peche, and I'm the Research and Project Manager at the Transverse Myelitis Association. We are a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website at myelitis.org. And during the call, if you have any additional questions, please send them to us via our Facebook page at facebook.com/myelitis.
Great. Thank you, Roberta. I am honored to be hosting this podcast today. This podcast is sponsored in part by Cronus. For nearly 30 years, Cronus has provided specialized immunoassay test kits to medical professionals at the world's most respected laboratory facilities. To learn more, please visit their website at www.cronus.com. Thank you to Cronus. I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Carlos Pardo from the Johns Hopkins Transverse Myelitis Center in Baltimore, Maryland, and Dr. Alan DeSena at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thank you both for joining us today. A big thank you to all our listeners for calling in and sending us your questions in advance. I will do my best to get through as many questions as we can today. To start us off, I thought we could begin by learning more about the Johns Hopkins Transverse Myelitis Center and the center at Cincinnati Children's. So, Dr. Pardo, can I turn it over to you?
Thank you, Chitra, and thank you, Roberta, for inviting me to participate in this podcast. And I appreciate all the patients and families that are joining this podcast. The Transverse Myelitis Center at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore was established in 1999, and it was the first center focused on studies of transverse myelitis. And our center used a comprehensive approach for evaluation of patients with the diagnosis of transverse myelitis. And the team of experts includes specialists in rehabilitation, neuroradiology, immunology, as well as a group of nurses, therapists, and people that are very well trained and focused on the management of the acute as well as the subacute and chronic problems associated with transverse myelitis. So for people that are interested in taking a look of what the Transverse Myelitis Center at Johns Hopkins may offer, you please can take a look in the website, and it's very easy. You just Google Johns Hopkins Transverse Myelitis Centers, and immediately you will get access to our website that contains all the information and contact information. If there is any need for direct phone communication, our phone number is 410-502-7099, and as for option one. And particularly, we have a very well-trained group of people that are ready to facilitate patient and family interaction with our expert specialist. And we'll be pleased if you are able to join us at Johns Hopkins Transverse Myelitis Center. Chitra?
Great, thank you. Dr. DeSena, I know you've recently moved to Cincinnati Children's. Would you like to share a little bit more about the facility there and what is offered in the Neuroimmunology Center?
Sure. As Chitra mentioned, I just moved here a few months ago, and I also like to say thank you for having me today, and thank you to all the patients listening in, and I also want to thank you to the Transverse Myelitis Association for just their continued support with me. So moved here a couple of months ago, and the Cincinnati Children's Medical Center has been very committed towards helping to grow a clinical neuroimmunology program and ultimately have that branch out into research initiatives. So having only been here a few months, things are still sort of in the early stages. However, definitely there are a lot of resources here and I've already seen there's always already been a few transverse myelitis patients that I've seen both in the hospital and have been referred from other facilities within Ohio for excuse me, for reassessment. In addition, one of the benefits of Cincinnati Children's is they have a very strong, as Johns Hopkins does as well, of course, and several other centers that I've worked, have been at and have been familiar with, but we have a strong physical medicine and rehabilitation program. We also have a one of the doctors, the physical medicine rehab doctors named Dr. Pruitt, has a spinal cord clinic in which he sees and primarily focuses on rehabilitation and management for patients with spinal cord injuries. And as I've said, I've been seeing patients as an outpatient as well, helping to kind of round out the team. And of course, there's all some of these other providers involved, urology, et cetera. But really, although we're in the early stages, it looks very promising in terms of growing the clinic over time. And so we're open for business. And if there is any interest in coming to Cincinnati, I can provide the main neurology number in terms of getting set up with me or other providers. It's 513-636-4222. Happy to be in Cincinnati, and I hope I'm anticipating that the program is only going to grow from here.
That's great. Thank you. So, you know, for our listeners, this Cincinnati would be sort of the third focused program on rare neuroimmune diseases after Johns Hopkins, Transverse Myelitis Center, and University of Texas Southwestern. Thank you both, you know, for focusing and dedicating your careers to studying these diseases. And I think, you know, with a lot that we're learning now, I think we're understanding more about transverse myelitis, and there are new terms being thrown out every time, acute flaccid myelitis. We have new, you know, new subtypes that we're seeing. So I thought it might be useful if perhaps you could start off with an overview, really, of what is transverse myelitis. Is TM now an umbrella term? Dr. Pardo, would you like to give us an overview?
Well, this is a very interesting opening for this conversation. What is the meaning of transverse myelitis? And the term transverse myelitis actually was established several decades ago. And in my view, I think that it's a very unfortunate term because it involves two words that unfortunately are frequently taken in the wrong way. So myelitis, by definition, is inflammation of the spinal cord. And majority of patients that experience problems that are diagnosed as transverse myelitis are evidently affected by an inflammatory process. The difficult part after identification of inflammation of myelitis is to characterize the cause of the problem, and that is precisely where many problems may begin, particularly because that process needs to be a careful process. Myelitis is an inflammation of the spinal cord that may be produced by different disorders. Demyelinating diseases such as multiple sclerosis may trigger process of myelitis. Infectious disorder and other type of post-infectious problems associated with viral diseases and other problems may trigger inflammatory damage of the spinal cord that eventually may translate in problems that are very similar to what we understand as transverse myelitis. And there are other potential problems that may mimic transverse myelitis without being really an inflammatory process. And that is a problem that is frequently seen with a patient that has, for example, mechanical damage of the spine in which herniated disc or deformation of the bones that comprise the spinal column may produce a mechanical pressure on the spinal cord and subsequently may produce either an inflammatory process or damage, direct injury of the spinal cord. And that is an important issue because if the cause of the inflammation is, for example, a mechanical compression, the treatment approach is going to be different as compared with other patients that may have, for example, immunological processes like autoimmune disorders like happen in neuromyelitis optica or post-infectious myelitis like happen in some cases of shingles or varicella zoster infection. So the identification of the diagnosis of myelitis is a critical step in the right approach for management. We are very concerned in the past a few years about the misdiagnosis of vascular problems as myelitis, particularly because the implications of the treatment that may have a patient with a vascular myelopathy rather than a myelitis. The two approaches, the two treatment approaches for those disorders are different. So establishing the right diagnosis is critical. So in summary, so the term transmyelitis may be a misnomer, but we may need to stick to that term for a while until we have a better understanding of the natural history of this disorder. But in the future, it's extremely important that both families, patients, and clinicians focus more on understanding the causes of the problem rather than sticking to a term like transmyelitis that may imply many different situations or may need different factors for management. Chitra.
Great, thank you. So, I mean, that is very enlightening. So, Dr. Desena, anything you'd like to add from a children's perspective, particularly in the light of, you know, the patients you're seeing now with acute flaccid myelitis, perhaps?
Sure. There's been a subset of patients that come in that looks like a myelitis event. Oftentimes, they will have spots in their spinal cord or lesions in their spinal cord. I know there's been a lot of news about these, about children presenting with paralysis and they continue to have, their tone is very low and they say it's flaccid or they have very low tone. And in a subset of patients that otherwise often meet the clinical criteria for transverse myelitis, it appears that there is a percentage of these patients, they have involvement of not only the spinal cord itself, but also the roots, the nerve roots, as they exit the spinal cord and become the peripheral nerves. And in addition, quite a few of those patients will also have particular involvement in the spinal cord of an area in the spinal cord where the neurons meet to control your arms and legs, the motor neurons. And in these kinds of cases, it looks like that there's not only just what they call central involvement, but a combined central and peripheral nerve involvement, at least to some degree. And so there appears to have been kind of several of these cases that have popped up recently in Colorado, but have been described throughout the country over the course of this last fall. Now, although there definitely looks like there was a spike in the number of events that happened with these kids, there have been case reports in the literature of patients that have had this type of pattern that have been described in the past, going back 10 years ago. However, it's difficult to kind of tie all those together in terms of exactly underlying cause, et cetera. There is a suspicion that there is a viral cause that's provoking the event, although it's still kind of being under investigation. On a quick separate note, some patients that do present with transverse myelitis that only have central involvement and they don't have this subtype often will initially appear to have low tone as well. And so I can understand how with some of these patients most recently, they have this subtype that there's a concern that they're not as recovering as well. However, it's very variable. And we've seen a case, even just at Cincinnati, and he had a pretty good recovery, not complete, but a pretty good recovery that did have that subtype. And so I think it's just very variable. We're still kind of I believe the CDC is involved in terms of kind of getting involved in studying, looking into issues in terms of how to study this, how to move forward, how can we kind of determine if there are risks, et cetera, down the road. However, it's our knowledge is growing, and Dr. Pardo makes very good points about mimickers of transverse myelitis, but that there's another cause that could impact our treatment. So we're still kind of trying to learn new things about it every day, and so. That subtype is definitely becoming a little bit more recognized as of late.
So talking about sort of causes and the fact that there are many causes, we've had a couple of questions come in. One was sort of alluding to diet being responsible for, transverse myelitis. Another question around ionizing radiation being responsible for the onset of TM. And there were a few other questions regarding sort of what are the causes for TM. Dr. Pardo, I understand there are several causes, but can we perhaps talk about what are some of the most common themes that you see that cause TM? Is diet an implication? Radiation has any implication?
Yeah. At the Johns Hopkins Transverse Myelitis Center, we have been doing research in the past several years trying to understand the natural history of the transverse myelitis diagnosis, and particularly the composition in terms of the different causes of this neurological problem. And the result of that study that was presented by our nurse and manager, Mori Mili, suggested that approximately three-quarters of a patient of transverse myelitis have inflammatory conditions frequently associated with either immunological disorders, autoimmune disorders, neuromyelitis optica, and other disorders triggered by infectious or post-infectious causes. And there is a very important group of patients that we call idiopathic transverse myelitis, in which there is definitely no clear cause of the term undiagnosed transverse myelitis. So there is a large percentage of patients that in which we don't understand and we don't know clearly what was the trigger of the transverse myelitis. And that is matter of a lot of research, because it's very possible that there are other agents, like viral agents, as it was suggested by Alan, that may be involved in the process of pathogenesis or causation of the neurological problem. And the result of our study that was presented as well suggested that at least a quarter of patients with the diagnosis of transverse myelitis, and that transverse myelitis in quotes, do not have really an inflammatory spinal cord process. And those are patients that fit in the category of vascular damage of the spinal cord produced by strokes or metabolic problems associated with a lack of vitamins, particularly vitamin B12, or lack of nutrients like a significant decrease in copper as a nutrient. And there are other disorders like mentioned by Chitra, like a post-radiation myelopathy, in which patients that undergo some type of radiation therapy for treatment of cancer unfortunately develop some complication after radiation that involve the spinal cord, and that is basically a focal damage of the spinal cord that we think and we believe is mostly associated with damage of blood vessels that produce changes that are similar to strokes of the spinal cord. So the approach to understand that is need to be very careful. So the use of a spinal fluid analysis and the use of imaging by a magnetic resonance imaging analysis is very critical for establishing correct diagnosis. And I want to make a parenthesis here because you mentioned diet, and some of the patients that send the questions ahead of time were concerned about the issue of diet and the potential triggering for spinal cord disorders. And it's very clear in the past several years, for example, that patients that were exposed to bariatric surgery for obesity treatment, for example, experienced spinal cord diseases that were triggered by lack of vitamins, particularly vitamin B12, and also nutritional deficiencies like copper deficiency. So those are very clear mimickers of the condition that we understand as transaminitis, and the clinician and the patient and families need to be very careful and critical in the assessment of the information that is being produced for establishing the diagnosis. And obviously, that is very important and critical for future management and treatment of the problem. Chitra?
Great, thank you. So, you know, now that you've mentioned diagnosis, maybe I can turn it over to you and Dr. DeSena. We got a question that says, my daughter got TM 5 years ago. Within a few hours, she was a complete para T10. The doctor said it was TM. She has absolutely no feeling and never did. Others with TM complain about pain and spasms. How do I know for sure that it is TM? And I know Dr. Pardo touched about, you know, diagnosis being critical. So when the presentation is not the same for everyone, you know, how do you diagnose? Are there some key steps that we should be taking?
It's a very, very good question. excuse me. Probably the most important thing when I first sit down with a patient that is coming years after the event in terms of kind of looking back at things is really going through the history very very slowly and carefully, time of onset to when the maximal neurologic deficit has sort of set in is kind of a key thing I kind of keep an eye on, so the TM criteria that was set forth many years ago has a very wide range of, you know, time from onset to the worst that the patient gets of 4 hours. I think it's 21 days or 22 days. And so it's very variable. There is a little bit of overlap in terms of there are certainly patients that I've seen that that had a fairly rapid onset, or it was unclear, or it seemed somewhat rapid, but otherwise seemed to have had an inflammatory cause for their myelitis, whether it's idiopathic or otherwise. But then there are those subsets that Dr. Pardo alluded to, that there is a concern for a vascular cause for the myelitis, and that can be a little bit more tricky to kind of sort out. And especially if, depending on what testing was not done at the time of the event. And as a general rule, vascular imaging is of the cord is not done at very many places routinely. In terms of going through a patient with an older diagnosis, see whether it does or does not fit that criteria. When I look at it, not only do I look at the really focus on the history, we of course look at the imaging itself and also spinal fluid testing, usually that was obtained, and also any other blood work testing that may or may not have been done, and in terms of helping guide families about what we think it was or was not. It's there are sometimes cases where we suspect that there maybe was a vascular cause or a non-inflammatory cause for their myelitis, but oftentimes we cannot be 100% definitive when we give that assessment. And then there are certainly patients that appear to have a diagnosis that clearly fits with what is considered idiopathic transverse myelitis, thought to be a one-time monophasic autoimmune event. Probably one of the more important things we can offer on patients that have been diagnosed with transverse myelitis in the past is if we do feel like sometimes if we feel that there may be some other testing to make sure that this is not going to be a recurrent event, sometimes we'll say, well, maybe we should get this tested or not. Oftentimes those patients will declare themselves, meaning if it's something recurrent, they have either had recurrences or not. And so we usually that's how we kind of I kind of round off the testing in terms of making sure that rare causes of TM in terms of rare neuroinflammatory causes that may recur are tested for or were tested for at some point, and also in terms of fitting into the entire picture, the imaging, the history, and the spinal fluid testing and other blood work testing to see whether they did clearly fall into, I think this was an inflammatory transverse myelitis, I think it was possibly not an inflammatory cause. That is a little bit difficult to sort out, especially if it's been several years ago, and especially if the amount of workup available to the family is limited. That's typically the approach we make. I tell families that, unfortunately, there is no definite yes-no test that I can send in either blood or spinal fluid, and even with the imaging, there are imaging findings that may suggest a non-inflammatory cause, and on the other side, that suggests that this is inflammatory. However, there's nothing for certain.
So you know, this is incredibly helpful. I mean, in the face of the fact that transverse myelitis is an incredibly complex disorder with multiple presentations, multiple causes, especially if it's idiopathic, you know, and a question that came from the community is, who are the essential specialists that one should reach out to and should be involved in treating and caring for someone with TM? I mean, in the acute stages, it's a neurologist. But going forward, I mean, who are the people that one should have and reach out to? Dr. Pardo?
So this is a very important question, and that is critical for all patients and family to understand. During the acute phase, the major issue is who is going to be taking care of a patient with transverse myelitis. And in the acute phase, obviously, the emergency department physicians, the pediatricians, the general practitioner, and very important members of the team that should be aware about diagnosis and management of transverse myelitis. Unfortunately, education about transverse myelitis for the general healthcare providers is not necessarily as good as we should expect. And that is an effort that the Transverse Myelitis Association has initiated in the past, and is trying to educate the emergency department, the pediatrician, internal medicine community, and other primary practitioners to understand better the characteristics and the diagnosis of transverse myelitis. So, who is going to be taking care of the patient at the beginning? And obviously, the diagnosis are frequently established in the emergency department, occasionally established by neurologists after several days, weeks, and then unfortunately even months after the initiation of symptoms. So I always use the term is this is like a football game. So this is not necessarily a neurologist taking care of everything. The neurologist is a critical player for the team, but there are a lot of players in the team that should be focused on the management of that patient. And the rehabilitation specialist, the physical therapist, the occupational therapist, the nurse practitioners and other people that are initially involved with the management and care of the patient during the acute stage are part of that team. And subsequently, after the acute phase is over, obviously the critical point is an assessment of the magnitude of the damage and clinical problems that the patient experienced after the acute transaminitis. And that is where the neurologist perhaps is not the most important member of the team. In that stage, the rehabilitation specialists and the physical therapists and other group of healthcare providers are probably extremely important because they are going to facilitate the process of recovery. And it's extremely important that those players interact each other and participate in a comprehensive approach to manage the different clinical problems. Alan mentioned before that it's very important to have a urologist on the team. It's extremely important to have a pain specialist on the team. It's extremely important to have a physiatrist or physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist. And obviously, people that are in the front and in the trenches of the clinical management, like the primary care physician, or nurse practitioner or nurses that are working with the patient need to be alert to the onset of problems and obviously need to be in a good communication with the other member of the team to facilitate the prompt treatment of complications or potential problems that may emerge during the subacute or the chronic phase of transaminitis. So the summary is, who is going to be taking care of a patient with transaminitis? Well, it should be a team. And that is one of the reasons the philosophy that the Transaminitis Association is promoting around the country, the establishment of centers, like it was initiated at Johns Hopkins with the Transaminitis Center, and was later initiated at University of Texas in Southwestern, and is now part of the effort that Alan is doing in Cincinnati, and perhaps it's the effort that other neurologists may have already in other centers, is to establish a comprehensive team management of patients with these disorders. Chitra.
Excellent. Thank you for that very comprehensive answer. So moving on from sort of diagnosis and causes to symptoms and treatments, we've had a few questions come in. One just came in through Facebook. It says, I was diagnosed with TM in 2013, idiopathic TM, and I'm experiencing severe muscle pain, and I'm told I should have lidocaine injections. I'm on a high dose of gabapentin, as well as low dose of hydromorphone. Is pain common with TM, and will lidocaine injections help? Dr. DeSena, would you like to start this one?
It's a very good question. So muscle pain is a symptom of patients with that have had transverse myelitis is, I would say, fairly common. In general, when patients have, and this speaks to the importance of multiple providers, not only to provide, to deal with multiple areas of expertise, but also to provide a little bit of, you know, also can helpful and be helpful in terms of providing different perspectives. So when a patient with transverse myelitis, so just in general, they say, I have pain, the first thing I discuss with them is the quality of the pain, what it sounds like, what it feels like, where it's located, et cetera, really trying to determine if I think the pain is primarily a neurologic pain, so neuropathic, so usually typically think of symptoms like burning, tingling, et cetera. And ultimately what's causing the pain was a neurologic event and with all of these patients. But then there's patients that can have pain related to muscles getting tight and getting tight and get they contracting and they get painful. And sometimes this is goes hand in hand with the patient's degree of what they call spasticity or how tight the muscle or muscle groups are. And sometimes patients will have flare-ups of this problem, often even times at night when they're trying to fall asleep after they've relaxed. And their muscles will lock and they'll get very painful. Then there's kind of there are other patients that kind of have kind of combinations of multiple types of pain that is also kind of that can sometimes be vague in terms of their description, or it's unclear whether if there's multiple components contributing to the pain. And then lastly, that there's are patients that sometimes will have secondary pain related to walking mechanics and putting stress on their joints, and so they can have joint pain or joint discomfort. And so that's kind of my general approach for patients with pain. What we end up in terms of recommending for treatment is quite variable, but also really dependent upon the type of pain I think the patient is or is not having. I personally typically have not seen a lot of transverse myelitis patients that were getting lidocaine injections. However, I know of I've seen patients with other neuroimmune disorders get those kinds of things. And I think any kind of intervention where there's a discussion about what is or is not the cause, it really just needs to be between the provider that's recommending it in terms of here's why I think this will or will not help, and an individual in terms of what they think about the risks versus benefits of the procedure. And, of course, as I mentioned, there's also overlap, and so sometimes there's multiple causes for pain, and so sometimes we need to use multiple different medications or different procedures to help alleviate the pain. So I would say it's a little bit difficult to from that particular question, although sometimes the patient is just saying, well, this is the symptom I'm having, this is how I describe it, and so I can understand that 100%. It really does speak to think to the importance of not only having neurologists get involved, but also pain medicine where considered appropriate. Sometimes a physical medicine rehab doctors can be helpful, especially if there seems to be a spasticity or muscle stiffness component to it, in terms of helping alleviate the patient's pain. So I know that's kind of a general overview response to that question, but I think it's probably the best I can do.
Yeah, and that's great. And, you know, we did a, for our listeners, we did a podcast specifically on neuropathic pain in May of 2014 with Dr. Scott Newsom from the Transverse Myelitis Center at Hopkins and with Dr. DeSena. And I think we talked more in detail about, you know, spent a whole hour on pain. So it's available on our website if you would like to go and listen to it. The other question, sort of the big themes that kept coming up around symptoms are, you know, I have a lesion in T2, T3 area. It has affected my right arm. I have numbness and heaviness, but I also have numbness on my right leg, top surface only. Is this a normal occurrence? Dr. Pardo?
The localization of the lesion is critical for defining the type of symptoms that a patient may experience. It's very possible that the patient that submitted this question may have experienced also some involvement of the cervical cord if there is evidence of symptoms affecting the right upper extremity. And frequently, we are guided by imaging studies to define the localization of the transverse myelitis lesion. But it's very frequent, actually, that the MRI is not necessarily the most fitting approach to localize. And the symptoms plus the neurological examination provided by the neurologist may give a better idea about the extension of the spinal cord involvement. Because frequently what we see in MRI, for example, is just large lesions that produce abnormalities in the spinal cord. But in transverse myelitis or any other type of myelopathy or involvement of the spinal cord, it's very frequent to the spinal cord experience also microscopical changes and lesions or damage that we are not able to see, but are manifested clinically by symptoms like numbness or tingling or even weakness or even other type of neurological involvement. So to summarize about the question given by the patient is, it's possible that is a focal involvement in the upper thoracic cord, but it's very likely that there are other type of involvement of the cervical cord.
Great, thank you. And I know there are so many questions coming in about recurrence, but before we go jump into that topic, we have another question on Facebook, and I wonder if you'd take it, Dr. DeSena. Says, we would like to know if there's any good information on whether Imuran prevents a relapse of a single idiopathic longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis event when aquaporin 4 antibody is negative. Or in other words, does it do any good taking it when there is a good chance of a no repeat attack?
This is a very good question. So in reference to NMO or neuromyelitis optica, which is a which was at one time thought to be some kind of a cousin of MS, but it's pathophysiologically distinct, and it tends to involve the optic nerves in the spinal cord. So there are criteria for neuromyelitis optica, of which the testing for the aquaporin 4 antibody is a part, but is not required. In patients that have had a longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis, it clearly appears to be idiopathic, meaning when I say idiopathic, I mean this is a one-time event. I typically do not put them on immunosuppressive medication unless I have other reasons to unless there were other events in the past in which there was eye involvement or optic nerve involvement that would meet the criteria or strongly suggest that that this was a what they call a seronegative NMO. It's a difficult question just because without knowing a lot of the details in terms of extrapolating in terms of what the provider is thinking by putting them on that medication, I would just say that if the general thought was that this was a monophasic event and that there are no other other events concerning for either recurrent myelitis or other events either in the either recently or in the past concerning for optic neuritis, it makes the diagnosis of NMO or neuromyelitis optica less likely, although certainly those patients deserve close follow-up, and oftentimes I'll repeat the antibody testing a few times just to ensure that it's negative. If I had a strong suspicion that it may have been that from initially, so I don't know what the data is on patients that are on Imuran, and if it's just the longitudinal sense of transverse myelitis in terms of risk of prevention of other symptoms that would be or other events that would be reflective of having of it being NMO. I don't know if I have that data in my head at this moment, but I would encourage the individual to talk with their provider about if they do or do not think it is clearly indicated, and mm-hmm. And why if they do, and kind of move forward from there. Certainly, like I said, this is a reason why some of these patients need to be closely followed by both neurology and other multiple providers.
That's very helpful. Thank you for taking a complicated question. In sort of transitioning now to conversion to MS, conversion to NMO, and recurrence, you've had a few questions, and people have asked sort of if you have family members with MS, what are the chances that TM will lead to also being diagnosed with MS, or what are the statistics we know on partial transverse myelitis developing into MS? And I'm sort of adding a third question to this from our Facebook page. It says, is there a correlation between hormones and flare-ups or recurrences? And I know you recently published a paper out of Hopkins data, and I think it was the next in paper. So maybe, Dr. Pardo, would you like to start this this question?
Yeah, this is a very frequent concern. And I will start with the concern about family members or a genetic component of trichomyelitis or the potential of other family being affected by trichomyelitis. As I mentioned before, in general, trichomyelitis comprise several diagnoses. And many of those problems, for example, autoimmune disorders, are not necessarily defined by specific genes that are going to be transmitted from one generation to another generation. So the concern that some of the cases of trichomyelitis are going to be familiar doesn't have any scientific base. So it's very likely that even with the background of an autoimmune disorder, the likelihood of another member of the family affected by trichomyelitis is very low. The issue of multiple sclerosis is quite fascinating, and it's very important because in the past 10 years, we have been learning more and more about multiple sclerosis, the overlap of trichomyelitis with some cases of multiple sclerosis, and we understand better some of the issues related with genetic susceptibility. By definition, multiple sclerosis is not a heritable disorder or a genetic-based disorder. However, what we are learning more and more is that there is a pattern of perhaps what we can call genetic susceptibility in which a mix of genes and particularly some characteristic of those genes that are called polymorphisms, when they combine with environmental factors or exposure to infection factors or other type of events, may translate in triggering demyelinating disorders. It's very possible that the same situation happened in other neuroimmune-related disorders like ADEM or acute disseminated encephalomyelitis or in any other type of autoimmune-related or immune-related disorders. This is a work in progress. We are still in the process of understanding these diseases. And with the advance of genetics and molecular biology, we are learning more and more. But the summary is, at this moment, there is no definite demonstration that such a genetic component exists. The last part of the question that refers to the chance of a myelitis or a focal myelitis evolving in multiple sclerosis has been the center of attention for many, many decades. And as you may know, and many of our patients know, trichomyelitis was diagnosed as part of multiple sclerosis for many, many decades. Only until the early 90s and perhaps at the beginning of the 21st century when we pay more attention about the natural history of trichomyelitis and multiple sclerosis, we realized that the two disorders are completely, completely different. However, as I mentioned before, there is a subset of patients with onset of myelitis or trichomyelitis that eventually may evolve in demyelinating disorders. And the reason is demyelinating disorders are diseases in which there is damage of the white matter, and the white matter is present in all areas of the central nervous system, the brain, the brainstem, and the spinal cord. So there are a subset of patients with multiple sclerosis in which the first or initial attack actually occur in the spinal cord. However, we also understand now that the profile of those patients may be a little bit different. However, I always emphasize that at the beginning of a process of diagnosing a patient with transaminitis, we need to be extremely careful to identify patients that may be at risk of multiple sclerosis. How do we do that? Well, a careful neurological assessment, a careful analysis of the information provided by the magnetic resonance images of the brain and spinal cord, as well as the cerebrospinal fluid. Those are the main elements that will provide information. Is there any risk for patients with transaminitis to develop a multiple sclerosis? Yes, there is a risk. There are several studies with different numbers, and the numbers have been calculated between 10 and 25% risk of developing myelopathic demyelination. However, again, this is work in progress because until the past 5 years, we have a better understanding of many other disorders that present as myelitis. For example, 10 years ago, we didn't have a good understanding of what is called now neuromyelitis optica. Only until the antibody for aquaporin 4 that was described as pathogenic for producing neuromyelitis optica was discovered was when we understood that this was a completely different disorder. So I think that, unfortunately, some of the epidemiological studies that have been published in the past 20 and the last 10 years are still biased in the way that they were performed with the diagnostic criteria that didn't establish correctly or didn't focus correctly in the characterization of the disease. My advice after the concern about multiple sclerosis is just to remain alert if there is any onset of new neurological symptomatology in other areas of the central nervous system different to the spinal cord. That's the moment in which a patient should consider discussing with the neurologist about those concerns about multiple sclerosis.
Chitra,
yeah,
can
you.
I also add a point? Can I also add
yeah.
a point about NMO and Wallace-Stevens transverse myelitis? This is just to piggyback my answer to the previous question and to add on to what Dr. Pardo was saying. One of the things I just wanted to add with that with patients that come in with a longitudinal sense of transverse myelitis, the key historical things I kind of focus on is if there were as if the syndrome was either preceded before the other neurologic symptoms like the weakness or numbness, et cetera. If they had really intractable vomiting or intractable hiccups, like really persistent hiccuping for like more than a day. And in a subset of patients, some have said intractable pruritus or itchiness. But those vomiting and hiccuping are probably the two things that in a patient with longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis, if they had that and if it was very clear and a very profound, would definitely push my concern closer to, even if the NMO testing is negative, that this may have been the initial manifestation of NMO. And so that's one thing that if any of the listeners have had preceding their longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis, if they had happened to have had that, then there is a little bit more concern for NMO. And I have seen some patients treated with an immunosuppressive agent after just that one event if they seem like they had a syndrome that seems to be very closely tied to neuromyelitis optica. And those particular symptoms for in a significant subset and a significant percentage of the presenting NMO patients with their first event will have had those symptoms, the vomiting and the hiccuping, that's really intractable going on for a day or longer.
Mm-hmm. That's very helpful. Thank you for that clarification. And, you know, in the last few minutes that we have, and there have been a few questions sort of around the long-term prognosis of TM and are there any medications for the disease? And as both of you have said, you know, in the medications are more specific to managing the symptoms. And yes, you know, there is intravenous steroids and plasma exchange and other things that you can give in the acute stages of the disease. And given that, you know, in the long term, it's physical therapy, it's rehabilitation programs, managing symptoms. What is the prognosis for long, you know, in the long term for someone with transverse myelitis? Dr. Pardo?
That is perhaps one of the most difficult questions for
And I've been giving you 2 minutes to answer. I'm sorry.
Right. but it's an important issue. And I think that outcome measures is a fascinating aspect of our clinical practice because many patients come to us and ask immediately, I'm going to recover from this transaminitis. What do I need to do? And what is the plan of that treatment for full recovery? And again, that depends entirely of the causes of the transaminitis. For example, there are post-infectious myelitis associated with some viruses that trigger a lot of immunological reactions that are very aggressive in the spinal cord and produce extensive damage, while there are other types of conditions like immunological conditions that eventually may produce some transitory abnormality of the spinal cord that eventually will recover almost completely. So recovery and outcome depends on the cause. Unfortunately, there is a lot of variety in the causes of transaminitis. So if there are immunological mediated factors like systemic disease, like lupus or other type of disorders, many of the factors associated with the outcome also depends on the magnitude of the systemic disease. If the disease is associated with an infectious disorder, it also the outcome of that situation will depend on the magnitude of the infectious process that occurred in that specific patient. If the disease happened because a non-reason, the outcome will depend on the extension and magnitude of the damage of the spinal cord. And again, in studies of the brain and the spinal cord, we always talk about real estate. And that means that the outcome of problems associated with damage of the spinal cord will depend on how extensive the damage was at the beginning. Because as extensive the damage is, as longitudinal extensive myelitis occurs, it's more difficult for the body and for the treatment approaches to normalize the situation and allow the body to recover promptly. Because I'm talking about outcome, I like to take these few minutes an opportunity to say medication alone is not the only approach to recover from transaminitis. And I always emphasize on this because patients and many families and patients believe that just by treatment with some medication like IV salumedrol, metoprednisolone, or immunosuppressive medications, that's the only recipe for recovery and treatment of transaminitis. The answer is no. Patients need to keep in mind that the only way to recover and improve is a very aggressive plan of physical therapy and rehabilitation. That is the only way that the central nervous system, and particularly the spinal cord, will facilitate the process of repair and recovery. So I always emphasize is rehabilitation, 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 and after that is physical therapy, and physical therapy.
That's great. Thank you. I mean, this has been extraordinarily informative. I know we didn't get to a few questions around fatigue and alternative therapies, but we have focused other podcasts this year on these topics. I'm hoping our listeners are able to go and download those podcasts from our website and listen to them. Thank you both very much for giving us your time, for spending an hour answering questions and sharing with us in such great detail about a disorder that's, you know, truly very complicated and difficult. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.